MechCast, Sunday, June 6th, 2016. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Well, it's been a little while since we last got together and talked, and of course, you know what that means. That means we have a ton of things to talk about in this episode. We're going to be talking about just about everything in the Apple universe. We're going to talk a little bit about Siri, about Apple Retail, get into the iPhone, what's next for Macs, going to be looking at Apple Watch a little bit, of course, Apple TV, and then rumors around some new products, upcoming stuff, announcements at WWDC, maybe, maybe not, updates, issues for iCloud, Apple Pay. Like I said, it's going to run the gamut in this episode. So we're going to have to strap in. It's going to be probably a long one, I'm going to guess. And then we, of course, are going to get to some great feedback. I got, again, another round of really great voicemails, audio comments from you, questions about the whole, you know, voice hub thing. I've got a little bit of a tip on Google and your privacy, and we're going to talk about the business of apps and also try to address a problem with an iPhone SE. So should be a fun episode, should be a good one. So stay tuned for all of that. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of our show sponsors. And we have a new sponsor here on the MacCast, Atlassian. You know, today, nearly anything is possible. And if we can dream it, our teams can build it. So how do you bring everyone together to create what's next? Well, you team up with Atlassian. They're makers of collaboration software that lets teams work and communicate better together. And they have a number of different products. You have Jira, which will let you assign, track, and manage tasks for any project, no matter how complex. That's the clarity of Jira. You can create and share content, organize results, and bring team members up to speed. That's the flexibility of Confluence. Instant messaging and video chat with your team from any device. That's the freedom of HipChat. And test, review, and manage code in real time. That's the power of Bitbucket. And I've used Atlassian's Bitbucket tool to work on a project with a remote team, and it was great. It allowed me to easily collaborate and track my changes in my code, deploy and test my code easily for the project. And it's a huge benefit to be able to see the changes others are making, and you know, especially when you're working remotely, the ability to use that to solve any code conflicts quickly and easily. You can communicate with the team better. It's just a really great product, and it really helped out on this coding project, this development project that I was working on. And I think one of the huge advantages of Atlassian is that you get all of these products and services from a single source. So you get a consistent user experience for your team across a range of tools that are going to integrate well together, from project management and tracking to communication to content sharing and code management. It's all in one place with Atlassian. So that's a real benefit. And also, you're dealing with one source for billing and support as well. So it just makes things so much easier. And you can check it out. Just visit Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. to see how Jira, Confluence, HipChat, and Bitbucket give your team everything you need to organize, discuss, and complete shared work. Atlassian, helping teams everywhere team up to create what's next. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So is Siri coming to your living room? Is it going to come home finally? There's reports this week that Apple is planning a Siri-based competitor to the Amazon Echo and the Google Home. They're calling this kind of the next big front for, you know, the next big fight for, I guess, our tech attention. I don't know how to put that quite right. But the report comes from sources who spoke to CNET. And really what might make Apple's effort a little bit different is they're saying that Apple may integrate a camera system into the unit that would detect who's in the room and then adjust the preferences and responses to be more personalized to you. To me, this seems like it would be hard to pull off, but remember, Apple acquired the facial recognition company, Emotient, I think that's how you say it, and they have technology specifically for that. Not only can it detect faces, but it can also decode the emotional intent that is in your facial features to kind of aid machines to help better understand what you're trying to communicate to it. So if they could pull it off, that would be great. But I'm just imagining, you know, a really wide angle lens, and depending upon how big of a room this thing is in and where it's sitting, you know, how's it going to find you, find your face, and then read facial expressions and things like that. Would be an amazing addition to that kind of technology, and would put Apple at an advantage over a system like Amazon Echo or Google Home. It's also being said that it's going to have HomeKit built in, but HomeKit currently lacks security camera support, and if Apple's going to build in a camera, it seems like that's something they should add to HomeKit as well. So maybe we'll get a two for one, who really knows? And they're saying it could ship by the end of the year, but more likely in 2017, or they also didn't rule out the possibility that it may never happen. You know, Apple does a lot of R&D projects that we get rumors about, things they're working on, testing and playing around with that never actually turn into consumer products. There were also some similar rumors that an upgraded Apple TV with a speaker and a microphone built in could bring always-on like Siri functionality to the living room. So I don't know if these are separate products or the same product. And then there was another thought that there would be integration of possibly this technology with Apple's AirPort technology. As a matter of fact, there was a brief time earlier in the week where the AirPorts were not showing up on the online store, but they came back later in the week. So kind of that speculation blew off a little bit. But Apple's also expected to finally show off a Siri SDK at WWDC. And, you know, I wonder how they're going to deal with the balance of security and privacy when they start allowing third-party app access to that data. I have a feeling it's going to be very controlled, very much in the way that apps are controlled within iOS and also within OS X, only having access to specific parts of the system, having to ask for certain kinds of permissions and access, and it really becomes more of a one-way than a two-way street. And I've talked about this a little bit, where I think this is going to be challenging for Apple as they move into AI and voice-controlled systems in integrating with third-party companies, because third parties generally are going to want access to more information, that kind of exchange of information. And Amazon and Google are, you know, they're willing to exchange that personal data. That's part of their business for advertising, for partnerships and things like that. But Apple's been on the opposite side of that. They err more on the side of protecting our consumer privacy. And so it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. But, you know, AI and voice technologies do look to be shaping up to be the next big thing. As a matter of fact, Pebble also has a new wearable called the Core that they announced that they're working on that's going to tap into the whole Amazon Alexa system. So, you know, this is going to be a really big deal moving forward. And I fully expect at some point that Apple will get into this space. Now, for that to happen, though, I think Siri is going to have to become a lot smarter. And, you know, many are saying, and I'd agree, that one of the keys is that Siri needs to have a better understanding of us. It needs to do a better job at understanding context of our conversations and the things that we're asking it, and the ability for Siri to learn from that. So she needs to be able to get smarter on her own. Now, luckily, Apple has also acquired a number of companies and technologies that indicate that that may be exactly what they're working on and what's been going on behind the scenes. And hopefully, we'll get to see some glimpses of that at WWDC. A lot of the focus this week came on a company called Vocal IQ. It was a small company out of Cambridge, England that Apple acquired, I think back in October. They have a system that is a self-learning, what they call a self-learning dialogue API. And it should offer a more conversational approach to Siri, more conversational capabilities for her. And more importantly, though, their system would give Siri the ability to learn from past conversations and apply what she learns to future interactions. So, i.e., she gets smarter, but not just smarter, she gets smarter specifically about you. And memory would be useful when you're doing future queries. So, for example, you might want to ask Siri, hey, or say to Siri, hey, I want to go see an action adventure movie at 8 p.m. And she would go out and search the local listings, maybe even your favorite theater, which she might know from some past conversations, and offer you up a movie time. But then, say later you change your mind, rather than having to start that whole conversation over again, you could simply just say, I've changed my mind now, and this could be an hour later. I've changed my mind now. I want a comedy at around 9:30. So you haven't said movie, you haven't given her any other keywords, but because of the earlier conversation, she can infer using the vocal IQ technology that, hey, oh, you want to change the movie that you're going to go see and you want to change the movie time. Most systems aren't able to handle that. So if Apple can integrate that technology into their voice system, that's going to be a huge improvement over some of the other technologies that are on the market. And at least one source claimed that prior to Apple acquiring Vocal IQ, its technology scored a 90% accuracy in difficult conversations. And that was compared to other systems on the market at the time, including Siri, Google Now, and Microsoft's Cortana, which only scored about 20% recognition in understanding those kinds of ongoing conversations. So this could be really huge and could be the good, you know, the big boost that we want to see in Siri. The tech is also supposedly better at filtering out ambient noise and, more importantly, adapting to accents, which has been a huge complaint with voice systems, especially, you know, regional dialects, thick accents, all those sorts of things can throw off Siri. And, you know, my friends in the UK and Australia, you know what I'm talking about, right? You've struggled sometimes with Siri getting her to understand you. So the Vocal IQ technology is supposed to help out with that as well. So this could be a big, big update that we see at WWDC with Siri, and I hope we do. To me, Siri's biggest limits really involve, I think, also not mining and reacting to the data that's already there. You know, being able to parse and pull that in from other sources. So things like location, you know, knowing that when I make a request at home versus in a restaurant when I'm out versus maybe at the office, that those should be interpreted differently based on the, you know, the context, you know, having that location context in mind. Also access to local data sets, you know, mining the location that I've put into my calendars. This is a big frustration for me, and I know I've brought this up before, but it's the biggest one. I put a location into a calendar event. Why can't I simply ask Siri, hey, give me directions to my next meeting? She can tell me what my next meeting is. She should also be able to know where I'm going and maybe even respond back and say, hey, there's traffic. You might want to try an alternate route. Those sorts of things, you know, tapping the maps data at the same time. And that cross, you know, data pollination, that hasn't happened. And that can all happen locally. So that doesn't even break kind of the security and privacy stuff that Apple is worried about. And then this ability to react to past behavior, to recognize that I prefer a certain chain of hotels or a certain kind of food when I'm looking for restaurants. And then when I ask about those in another location or another place or at another time, suggest those first. Or, you know, if I prefer an alternate route all the time in terms of my maps, right? There's historical tracking when you're using maps. She knows where you go. So why not, when you're asking to go from point A to point B, maybe you take the longer back route all the time, even though it's not the fastest one. She should immediately know that and just offer that up to you. So getting a lot smarter, I think, is going to be a big key for Siri moving forward. I think Apple already recognizes this, and I think we're going to see some hints of it at WWDC. It'll be interesting to see if we see that standalone product, and we'll talk a little bit more about that a little bit later in the show. There was a report out this week from Business Insider who talked to a longtime Apple retail employee in the UK. And in the report, they try to expose like a lot of the negative aspects, I think, of working at an Apple retail store, citing things like low wages, I think £8 an hour, which is about $11.70 US, no promoting from within. They talk about a lot of the internal policies that don't allow part-time employees to go full-time, horrible customers who are abusive and often will issue even death threats to the Apple employees on the floor, specifically geniuses, and the fact that they don't get any sales commissions or bonuses for the stuff that they sell, so they're not really incentivized beyond their, you know, what this person at least considered the low hourly rate. They also said that, you know, employees are banned via non-disclosure agreements from talking about working at Apple online and blogs or social media. And if you followed Apple for any amount of time, you know that, you know, this is the reality. But I'm reading this report and I'm trying to be sympathetic. I'm trying to understand, but I've worked in retail, and as anybody who has worked in retail will tell you, it's basically, friggin' retail. That is how it goes. Working in retail stinks. You are dealing with customers a lot. The customers get irate and irrational and annoying. And you are working generally for a minimum wage or just above minimum wage salary. That's part of working in retail. That's sort of how it goes. So I wasn't really sure where this piece was trying to go. The piece does talk about retail employees also not being able to afford the products that they sell. Well, welcome to being young. You know, we all went through this. So, you know, I'm older now and it gets better. But, you know, the typical employee working at an Apple retail store is in high school or going through college. And this is the kind of work that we generally get. I had these jobs. You probably had these jobs. A lot of us do. So this didn't seem like anything really big. And when this person was working, the national minimum wage in the UK was around £6.50. So at £8, they were already $1.50 over the minimum wage. So that's not bad. You know, that's doing pretty good. And pay raises were on a typical, you know, 3-band system. And so they were complaining, well, you only get a bump if you're in the second band, meaning when you have your review, you know, you have to be doing, better than average or above average, or they're not going to bump up your salary. And again, that's how it works pretty much everywhere that I worked when I was working in a retail job. It's pretty common. And even after that, you know, some of my jobs after that, you had certain tiers, performance tiers that you had to hit. And if you didn't hit the upper tiers, guess what? You didn't get a raise, right? You had to stay at the same level and you had to do better. Now, the piece isn't all negative. They does go through some of the benefits of working at an Apple store. They say, you know, the workers are great, the camaraderie is great, you're among a lot of creative people, and that's really fun. You get discounts on Apple products and also a 15% discount on buying Apple stock if you want to buy into that. And it does talk about, and I've heard this from other people I know who've been at the Apple retail store, they offer a lot of training opportunities internally. So you can learn new skills, you can expand your skill set. Yeah, they don't necessarily promote from within, but I've heard again from other people that I know that you can still apply for higher end positions. So if you've improved your skills, you're more than welcome to try and get one of those other positions that are opening up. Typically, though, for management positions and things like that, Apple often does hire based on experience, and a lot of times they're pulling in from outside. And then another big one that I think that Peace really fails to mention is that even part-time employees at Apple get full health benefits. So in the US, that is a huge, huge deal. Maybe not so much internationally, depending upon which country we're talking about. But, you know, these are some things. And, you know, as far as some of the negatives go, there are some good reasons for some of the policies. The whole no commissions on sales thing, you know, one of the complaints was, well, you know, if I sell a bunch of Mac Pros to a business customer, you know, it could be $100,000. I'm not getting any commission on that. Well, that's because Apple really doesn't want their customers in the retail stores to be pressured to buy something. So when they come in, you know, they want that no pressure. They want you to feel welcome. And I think that's ultimately a good thing. The piece also talks about some of those strange questions you'll get asked by the retail employees. They're told to ask you about personal things, you know, things like, I think the example they gave in the piece is, what's your favorite flavor of ice cream? And while that may seem weird, it's about making a connection with a customer by pretending to be interested in them and asking personal questions. And I say pretending, you know, they're not really interested in you, but it still feels good, right? When you're in there, when they seem to be interested in what you're into, they maybe ask you about your job, what you do, what your hobbies are, all those things just help develop a rapport with the customer. And I think Apple also recognizes that a lot of us, if we go to an Apple retail store, we're going into the same retail store over and over again. So oftentimes I'll see the same people and they start to get to know you a little bit better. And they may not remember your name, but they recognize your face and those sorts of things. And I think that's nice. So, you know, it sounds like you can internally be promoted to the Genius Bar, you know, and many don't like doing that because you're dealing with angry customers. And the angry customer thing, I get. You know, I've seen it in my own Apple retail stores. People get really passionate about this stuff. And we've talked about it on the show. You know, it's a lot better if you go in as a customer, and we can do our part too, right, to help this out. Especially if you've ever worked in retail, you know, go in, try to be kind, you know, be firm, make sure you get what you want, but you don't have to, you know, issue a death threat or call the person on the sales floor an idiot or something like that to their face. That's just, you know, be nice, be kind, be considerate. These are human beings. They're not getting paid a lot of money. You know, they're maybe working their way through college, and have a little sympathy on that side of things, you know, and it really goes both ways. But, you know, this was another one of those interesting pieces. This comes out every once in a while, you know, this Apple retail thing. But I think overall, if you talk to the people who've worked at Apple retail stores, you know, after they've left, it was an overall good experience. A lot of them, you know, it's generally very positive. So it's funny when they try and spin this in a real negative way. But when I read the piece, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes at MacCast.com, even overall, you know, I just kept thinking, hey, it's retail. Welcome to retail. And Apple retail seems better than most, at least in my opinion. So it might finally be happening, the death of the 16 gigabyte iPhone, at least if a source from IHS Technology is to be believed. They claim that the iPhone 7, starting with the iPhone 7, which should be out this fall, Apple will bump the base model storage option up from 16 gigabytes to 32 gigabytes. And I think this is great. 16 gigabytes is a crime. If you have friends and family, you know, looking to buy an iPhone, do not let them get the 16 gigabyte model. Everybody I've known who has bought one has eventually used up all their storage, and you can't upgrade them. So I know there's people that can get by with 16, but I think that's a rare, rare instance. So it's good to see Apple is finally going to maybe make that transition. The report also claimed that the iPhone 7 will have 2 gigabytes of RAM, just like the iPhone 6S. If you remember, we've been hearing that the iPhone 7 Plus is rumored to have 3 gigabytes of RAM. So this piece didn't talk about the difference between the 7 and the 7 Plus. And there's also been rumors that on the upper side of storage, we might see a 256 gigabyte iPhone on the top end model. And it's not 100% clear at this point how then the whole lineup will shape up. Is it going to be 32, 64, and 256, or is it going to be 32, 128, and 256? I'm leaning toward the latter. And I don't see them going 32, 64, 128, and 256. I think that's going to be too many options. Although there has been speculation that maybe the 256 gigabyte size will only, once again, be on the iPhone 7 Plus. So, you know, in that case, I guess you'd see 32, 64, 128 for the 7 and 32, 128, 256 for the 7 Plus. But again, I think that overcomplicates things. So I'm going to put my vote on 32, 128, and 256. Love to know your opinion. Let me know. Send me an email, mattkess@gmail.com. But as far as the overall design of the iPhone 7, it's expected to remain the same. The antenna lines across the middle back of the phone are expected to go away. So it's just going to kind of be minimized and around the top. And I think they're going to do a little bit better job likely with the color matching as well with the metal, so it's going to blend a little bit better. There's possibly going to be a less protrusive camera bump, although different renderings have been kind of showing that differently. And then we're still expecting the dual camera system on the iPhone 7 Plus. And, you know, I am waffling. If that dual lens system is only on the iPhone 7 Plus, I may be tempted and forced back into the Plus market. You know, if you've been listening to the show for a long time, I am not a fan of the large size. But more and more, it's sounding like that model is going to have some significant new features that are going to put it really above the iPhone 7. And I think it's deliberate on Apple's part. I think they're trying to get us to spend more on iPhones, which is a great business tactic. And I think they may likely pull it off. They may get me buying a phone that I don't want in terms of size, and that's going to be interesting. As far as iPhone sales, IDC thinks Apple could see an overall decline in iPhone shipments this year. They're predicting 227 million units versus the 232 million that Apple shipped in 2015. And that would be overall against the predicted growth of the smartphone industry, which is expected to grow about 32% this year, or 3.2% rather, not 32%, 3.2% this year. And that might not look good for Apple, but IDC believes that Apple's going to bounce back in 2017. They're saying it's going to be helped along by the lower price models like the iPhone SE and by their trade-in programs, which are really encouraging more frequent upgrades. I'm not 100% sure on that one. My personal feeling is I think the decline is going to kind of continue year over year, you know, very slowly. I don't think it's going to be a huge drop off, but you know, I think we're in for a future where there's a longer upgrade cycle for most consumers between phones. There's just not enough new features, I think, to warrant upgrading every year. And I think a lot of people who maybe upgraded every year because there was some significant new feature, they might drop off to a two-year cycle, and maybe some of the people on two-year cycles even drop off to a three-year cycle. So I think there's just going to be a general slowing of the smartphone market. And I don't think it's just going to be Apple. I think it's going to be everyone. And then, you know, another reason for maybe not going to the 7 is the 8. You know, we're hearing that the bigger design changes for Apple might happen with the iPhone 8 next year. And some are even expecting that Apple, because the design changes are going to be so significant, they're going to skip the S cycle this time around, that they won't go iPhone 7, then iPhone 7S. It's going to be iPhone 7, iPhone 8. As far as what's going to be in there, we've been hearing that'll be the big switch to an OLED display for Apple. And I've also heard a rumor of an enhanced haptic engine that would offer more complex vibrations, so better haptic feedback for features like 3D touch, maybe a little more localized. They didn't go into a lot of details as to what that would be, but Apple's working on something, I guess, in that area as well. And then Japan's Nikkei newspaper claims that Apple is going to move to major iPhone model refreshes on a three-year rather than a two-year cycle. And again, I think this is going to make a lot of sense. You know, there are fewer major features or design moves that Apple can really make. The last several cycles, if you've noticed, it's been the same kind of bullet points: faster processors, more RAM, better camera. And, you know, you get some major advances here and there, like Apple Pay and 3D Touch, but those are becoming fewer and far between. And so I could see moving to updating the iPhone rather than every year on an 18-month cycle with, you know, minor refreshes on the odd years, that whole TikTok thing, and then the major ones falling 3 years apart. And again, I think that's going to fall more in line with the consumer buying cycle that we're moving into. And I think it's a smart move for Apple, and it makes a lot of sense. So not going to surprise me if that's what we see happening. What's next for Macs? We've gotten some new component parts that look pretty interesting for the future of the Mac. Specifically, Intel has four new CPUs based on the Broadwell E architecture, and these could be ripe for high-end Macs like iMacs or even the Mac Pro. Now, historically, the Pro uses server processors, but this E series is what Intel calls server grade and has, you know, the server grade price tab to come along with it. It comes in 6, 8, and 10 core versions. The 10 core version, $1,700 just for the processor. So, you know, it would really only be appropriate for a Mac Pro. And a lot of people are really hoping that Apple has a Mac Pro update in the work. It's works. It's getting pretty long in the tooth. You know, I say maybe the Mac Pro processor of choice, because also four months ago, Intel did announce their lineup of the latest Xeon chips, which is typically what Apple uses, and we haven't seen an upgrade yet. So they could go either way. They could go with the upgraded Intel Xeons. Those are about 4 months old, or they could go with this newer Broadwell E line. I don't know when Apple would put out a model. Typically, you'd think they would announce it at WWDC, but they could wait a little bit longer. There are some rumors that they would have the Mac Pro ready to launch at WWDC, and if they did that, I think we would see the Xeons because the timing works out more with that timeline. Intel also announced its seventh generation of Core processors, which will arrive later this year. They're codenamed Kaby Lake. They also announced Apollo Lake processors, but those are designed more for two-in-ones and tablets. And as you know, Apple uses their own processors for iPads. So as far as Intel goes, we're looking at the Kaby Lake processors. They use a 14 nanometer process, and they support Thunderbolt 3 and USB 3.1, but not DisplayPort 1.3. And that's significant because DisplayPort 1.2 only allows a 4K monitor on a single cable and not a 5K display. One of the reasons why Apple in the iMac actually built its own controller systems was to get around that limitation. And it's why, also why, like on an iMac, a 5K iMac, you can't, through the DisplayPort, hook up a second external 5K display. But the Kaby Lakes look like they're prime for the next generation of Macs, which should be arriving in the fall. Another thing we saw, a component part that looks interesting for the future of Macs, is Samsung is showing off a new 512 gigabyte SSD module that's the size of a postage stamp, with data rates that surpass the 6 gigabit per second SATA interface. So really fast, really small 512 gigabyte SSD modules. That gives me hope for maybe MacBooks and MacBook Pros with a terabyte or more of internal flash storage running at really high performance. A lot of us have been waiting for that for a while. So 2 terabyte, 3 terabyte systems. I don't know. It's going to get very expensive. You know, those chips are cool. They're small, but they're not cheap. So we'll have to see how that shakes up in the lineup. And then finally, a supposed image of a MacBook Pro top case and keyboard surfaced, and it shows a channel for what many believe is going to be an OLED touch display. So Apple getting rid of the physical function keys and going with virtual keys. And it seems to confirm a rumor by Ming-Chi Kuo. And it would allow for software custom configuration of controls. You could use that display for all kinds of stuff, I would imagine, especially if Apple opens up an API to third-party developers to access that. And this top case also shows 4 USB-C slots and a headphone jack. And so I think that's where the Mac Pro is heading. You know, you can do Thunderbolt 3 over a USB-C connector. So you'd essentially have 4 ports that could be used for USB, Thunderbolt, DisplayPort, and or power all across the Mac Pro. And it could be ultra thin and just amazing. So I'm looking very much forward to seeing the next generation of MacBook Pro. And that's another thing that we could see at WWDC, although it's not clear at this point. There was a report out this week that claims developer interest in developing Apple TV apps is going up, while Apple Watch interest seems to be going down. This is based on data from a company called Realm. They make an app database used by over 100,000 developers, and they're just looking at who's using their software in their apps. And they said for every 1,000 iOS apps being built with their technology, there's about 10 tvOS apps being built and maybe one Apple Watch app. And, you know, I would say, yeah, but those numbers seem to make sense. And I'll also point out that with the next generation of watchOS, things may change. You know, the report seems to kind of forget that the current version of watchOS, you have to build an app for the iPhone. You can't have a standalone watch app or a native watch app, and that's going to change here pretty soon. So being able to build standalone native apps, I think, is going to change that a little bit. It also doesn't really think about the Apple Watch platform. You know, there's far fewer opportunities for creating an app just because of the limited size of an Apple Watch screen. You know, there's only so much you can do. We've seen it for different kinds of control surfaces, little bits of small information. And a lot of times it makes sense that that data would be coming from an iOS app anyway. So, you know, the database being on iOS makes sense in a lot of cases and not being standalone. So I didn't read too much into this report. You know, tvOS is kind of the new big thing. And there is, within tvOS, a lot more opportunities for apps. You know, you have entertainment apps that you'd never see on a watch screen. So wasn't really, didn't put a lot of stock in this, and it just seems to make sense. Yeah, developers aren't going to be developing as many watch apps as they are going to be developing TV apps or apps for iOS. And then one other quick thing on the watch front. Some of the Coach bands, Coach leather bands, were spotted on the Coach website this week, kind of via a secret URL. So it looks like they're getting ready to set those up for a release. There were no pricing or availability. They actually showed that they were out of stock. We did know that Apple was supposedly partnering up with Coach for their next generation of, you know, partner bands, and those could be, again, announced at WWDC just based on the timing of these showing up on the Coach website. So if you're an Apple Watch band collector or into that sort of thing, there may be an exciting new announcement for you in the next week or so. Now, IHS also came out this week and said that Apple TV is in third place for global set-top box revenue in 2015, and that's up from being in ninth place in 2014. Now, they said they're in third place behind Aris and Technicolor. Yeah, I didn't even know those were players in the set-top box market. I'm assuming those are set-top boxes, you know, like the kinds of things that you get from your cable company. I think Aris acquired 3Com and Technicolor acquired some other company who had been making set-top boxes or set-top box technology. But I found that number interesting, that Apple would be in third place in global revenue, because typically you think of Apple being behind companies like Roku, Amazon, and Google. And as a matter of fact, in the U.S., it still is being reported that Apple's in fourth place behind those companies. But 50% of the devices sold by Roku, Amazon, and Google are the stick-like devices. And so I guess maybe technically those aren't set-top boxes. And maybe those weren't factored into the IHS report. So I'm thinking that's what's going on. And in other Apple TV news, you may have noticed that Apple has made a small tweak to the Tops app list on your Apple TV. Because now if you've installed an app on your Apple TV, it will not show up in the top list. So it's almost like it's not truly just the top apps, it's the top apps that you have not installed, which I actually like. I think that's a little bit better. I don't want it showing me, you know, things that I've already installed, because I already have those. And really, I think the top list in many cases is about discovering new apps that you might want to put onto your Apple TV. So that was pretty cool. And then, oh man, Jeff Bezos came out at Recode this week. You know, the Recode conference was going on and they did interviews with several people. Jeff Bezos, we're going to talk a little bit about Elon Musk a little bit later when we get to Apple Car. But they asked him about why the Apple TV was not being sold on Amazon anymore. And Bezos basically said, because they only sell devices that have Amazon Prime, and they won't be doing that until Apple has, quote, acceptable business terms. And they asked him what he meant by that. And I would have assumed it was having to do with the 30% on in-app purchases. But they pressed him a little bit and asked him specifically, you know, is it the 30% take on, you know, Apple taking the 30% if that was the concern? And he would only respond saying, private business decisions should stay private. Again, not really sure what that means, but, you know, it's crazy to me that they have not built an Amazon Prime Video app for the Apple TV because they're not blocked from doing it. I can't imagine any business decision that would prevent them from doing it. The only one you can think of is that they wouldn't be able to sell Amazon Prime as an in-app purchase because Apple would take 30% in that scenario, but they're not required to do that. And they already have an Amazon Prime Video app on iOS. And the way they get around that on iOS is they send you to the browser if you want to purchase a movie or, you know, that isn't available for Prime streaming, or if you want to sign up for Amazon Prime. They just direct you to a URL, and you can do it in the Safari browser. And so the issue may be, the only thing I can think of is the issue is that there's no browser on the Apple TV, so they can't send you over there. But Amazon could develop an Amazon app for Apple TV where you just purchase stuff through Amazon, and they could direct you over to an Apple TV Amazon app. They haven't built that either, but there's nothing, I don't think, to prevent them from doing so. And, you know, with e-commerce apps on Apple TV, that's fully allowed. They can take credit cards. They can do all that sort of stuff. You can have your Amazon one click. So that seems to be the route to go. So I really am just back to, you know, this is just sour grapes. Apple and Amazon have not had a good relationship. You know, I don't think Apple has any issues with Amazon wanting to bring their stuff to Apple TV or iOS. But, you know, because of things like the whole book lawsuit and all those other things, I think that Bezos really just doesn't want to play ball with Apple. And I think it simply comes down to that. Not, you know, this idea that they need to reach acceptable business terms. But, you know, I'd love to get your take on that. If you disagree, if you think differently, let me know, mattcast@gmail.com. So will there be a 5K Thunderbolt display? The Thunderbolt display has been out for a long, long time. It's probably, you know, the least updated product Apple has ever released. I don't know. Maybe that's not fair to do it. But we're hearing rumors now of a project codenamed Yeti. And it states, it started out actually as a report that Thunderbolt displays were in limited stock at Apple retail stores. The current Thunderbolt display is about 5 years old. It's showing its age, especially with new 4K and 5K models on the market from, you know, other vendors. And there were these rumors that Apple was going to finally update to a 5K display. And it started with this report at 9to5 Mac. They said the Thunderbolt display would be based on the 5K 27-inch iMac display, 5120 by 2880 pixels. Have a built-in USB-C connectors and support Thunderbolt 3. But as we talked about earlier, the issue with a new Thunderbolt display using Thunderbolt 3 is that Thunderbolt 3 and the USB-C connection only support DisplayPort 1.2, which can only drive a 4K resolution at 60 Hertz over a single cable. In order to do 5K, you need DisplayPort 1.3, and that's not part of the Thunderbolt spec. So what we then heard was that Apple was working around the limits of the 5K display by building in a graphics card. And that would be to take advantage of the speed of the Thunderbolt bus, but basically move the graphics card out of the Mac and put it right in the display. And then they could do the same kind of thing that they did with the 5K iMac, build their own timing controller, and get around the 5K problem. And it would also be great because it would ensure that any Mac that had a Thunderbolt 3 connector on it, or Thunderbolt 3 support on it, rather, could use the display regardless of what their built-in GPU would be. And it would be smart enough to look at, you know, can this be driven by the built-in GPU or do we need to use the external one? And it could kind of figure that out. And the 9 to 5 Mac report said that Apple could announce this new display at WWDC for release later this year. And that was going great for about 24 hours. And then Rene Ritchie came out on Twitter and threw a little bit of cold water on the rumor. His basic point was being that adding a GPU to a display would create a, quote, exceptional debt. And I'm not 100% sure what he meant by that, but I felt that the issue with the rumor was that Apple historically has been slow to update the display, so putting a GPU in it would make it quickly fall behind and kind of become outdated. So if Apple were to go that route, I think the debt that Rene alludes to is that Apple would then have to kind of frequently update another piece of hardware. And, you know, a display, they sell so few of them, it's such an ancillary product that I don't think that it's something that Apple would have to continue every year, you know, maintaining, upgrading the GPU and doing that sort of thing. So, you know, I don't know. I'm kind of, you know, lukewarm on this rumor. I think Apple should update the Thunderbolt display, whether it moves to a 5K display or not at WWDC. I'm giving this about a 30% chance of happening. And by the way, I totally made up the code name Yeti. I was just joking around with the fact that, you know, it's an elusive kind of product that we're likely not going to see. As far as WWDC goes, Apple sent out invites for the keynote, which will happen on Monday, June 13th at 10 a.m. Pacific time. So expect, you know, a lot of news and information on a future MacCast not long after that date. As far as what we expect to see, Apple, I think, is certainly going to show off the next versions of all its operating systems, iOS 10, OS 10 10.12, or probably more appropriately, Mac OS. Remember, we're expecting OS 10 to be rebranded as Mac OS, and then new versions of tvOS along with watchOS, I guess, 3 at this point. Possibly that new Siri API. I actually think Siri is going to be a big front and center focus for Apple at WWDC, or at least I hope it is. And, you know, that would include adding third-party app support via an SDK and showing off some of that and how that's going to work. It's also expected that Apple may show off a redesigned version of the Apple Music app. And I really hope that iTunes gets completely rebranded as Music, just like it does, like did on iOS, and maybe even gets broken apart. But we haven't been hearing that in the rumors, and it's probably not going to happen. That's just my huge wish list, that Apple finally, you know, kills off iTunes and gives us something better. As far as where the keynote's going to happen, it's going to be at the Bill Graham Civic Auditorium, and the rest of the conference is going to happen over at Moscone West in San Francisco. So, should be a good show. I'm expecting a lot of great things to come out of it. As far as some of the more out there rumors that are out there, rumors of an airport refresh, that was kind of based on airports being pulled from the Apple online store, you know, showing out of stock on the Apple online store. Those are back in stock now, so I'm not sure what was happening there. And then, you know, this potential rumor of Apple showing off a home voice control device like the Amazon Echo, maybe something that's integrated possibly into an updated Apple TV, but I'm not really expecting that to happen at WWDC. That might be something that's more held off until the fall announcements. So we'll know more after Monday, June 13th. And then things seem to only be getting worse for Apple's cloud. You may have noticed they suffered a major outage this past week. On Wednesday, Apple Music suffered an extended outage. Many people were hit by an unable to connect to iCloud Music Library message. So if you were using iCloud Music Library, you didn't have access to your music. And then, unfortunately, there were some people even reporting that their music libraries were disappearing Again, we were hearing about deleted music or missing libraries, though it was unclear if this was just a side effect of not having access to music in the cloud and, you know, the music wasn't really being deleted locally or what. You know, I have a feeling some people don't realize that, you know, when you're using iCloud Music Library, sometimes you're actually streaming stuff directly from the cloud. So if you lose cloud access, well, yeah, you lose access to your music as well. And the outage didn't just happen to Apple Music. It actually impacted a number of other services, including the App Store, Apple TV, the Mac App Store, and iCloud services. So, you know, there were a lot of angry Apple customers, Apple Cloud users on Twitter last Wednesday, though not everyone was impacted and not every service was down for everyone. So it was a really weird outage. I didn't suffer any issues other than I think I did have a little kind of blip in Apple Music, but it was very minor and it wasn't for the extended outage period. But there were people that were down for several hours and didn't have access to a lot of services. So Apple hasn't commented on exactly what happened. They only acknowledged that there was an issue and that they were working on it. I wish Apple would be a little bit more transparent about this stuff and come out after the fact and say, yeah, we had this major outage, services were down for 4 or 5 hours, here's what happened, here's why. But they're generally tight-lipped about that stuff, and that's just what we've come to expect from Apple. Apple also finally pushed out a fix for iOS 9.3.2 for owners of the iPad Pro 9.7. You may remember that after Apple released the update a couple weeks ago, some owners of 9.7-inch iPad Pros started reporting that their devices were being bricked. Basically, the impacted units were simply getting an error 56 message after running the update, and that's just a generic hardware error. Apple never commented or said what the issue was. Again, all they said was that they were aware of it and were working on a fix. So now finally the fix is out. So if you suffered a bricked iPad Pro 9.7, I assume you'll have to run the update via iTunes because, you know, maybe your iPad isn't working, and get the latest version and install that. If you haven't updated your iPad Pro 9.7, it does appear to be safe to do so now via the over-the-air update or through iTunes. And not everybody was hit by that. There were a lot of iPad Pro 9.7 customers who updated just fine to 9.3.2. So who knows what the combination of variables were, but it supposedly is fixed at this point. Apple Pay adoption appears to still be slow. Actually, in 2015, U.S. Apple Pay was used to transact almost $11 billion in purchases, according to a research firm called Timetric. They called the figure a, quote, small dent in the overall global payments market, but said that Apple still seems to have a bit of a battle as they roll out internationally. You know, we've talked about this. They've met resistance from banks, especially over their 13% of the bank transaction fee requirement. In many countries, the banks don't get a large percentage on transactions. So Apple taking that 15% really cuts into their revenue. And that's been kind of a stopping point. We've seen it happening in Australia and Canada, kind of, and even in the UK, I think. Still, they've done pretty well expanding into those regions. Australia's on board now. I think Canada, they just recently added the final major bank in Canada. So most of Canada is covered in terms of Apple Pay. And they've even made some small headway in China, but are still struggling against the already established systems like WeChat. And I still feel that in the US, the biggest challenge for Apple in terms of Apple Pay is adoption by retailers. I don't know how this is outside the US. Maybe if you're in another country, you can comment on this. But, you know, the frontline battle seems to me to be the most important one if Apple really wants to get consumer adoption. You know, the fact that I can't reliably go in to a retailer and know that I'm going to be able to use my Apple Pay is a big issue. You know, it's great if I can register my credit cards, if my bank's supporting it, the card companies are supporting it, but if I can't use the service when and where I want, what's the point? Until they really have total ubiquity, like a card that I can pull out of my wallet and either dip or swipe, whatever the transaction is, that always works. It works with every card that I have in my wallet. It works all the time. It works at almost every retailer I go to. And, you know, I think most consumers are going to opt to take out the card rather than their phone or use their Apple Watch if they don't know that it's going to work. And I know this kind of stuff doesn't happen overnight, and I know that Apple is making progress, but it just seems really slow. And I think they could be really trying to incentivize retailers a bit more. They should have some better partnership programs, things that they're doing. And maybe they're doing this stuff already and they're just hitting a lot of resistance. It's just we haven't been hearing about that. And I haven't been hearing about any of Apple's efforts to kind of really reach out to retailers and make a big retail push for Apple Pay. We saw the announcements that they were going to have all these retailers, but a lot of them seem to be dragging their feet. So I'd really like to know what's going on in that front. And, you know, I'd really like to see Apple step up and do that. And I think once they start doing that, Apple Pay is really going to start taking off. But right now, I love using it. I try to use it as much as possible. But the overall experience is just not anywhere as ubiquitous or as good as just using, you know, using your card. So there's a little bit of an uphill battle. I would agree with that. But, you know, 11 billion in U.S. transactions last year, that ain't too bad. And then finally, let's talk about Apple Car a little bit, because Elon Musk talked about it a little bit in his Recode interview. He actually had some good and kind of bad things to say. He said that he thinks Apple's late to the game in terms of bringing a car to market. He expects volume production to begin in 2020. That aligns with some other rumors. But he did say that he thinks that Apple will be more of an automotive industry contender than Google. So that was pretty kind. I guess the thoughts on Google come mostly from the belief that Google's not really going to make their own car. They're going to license the technology rather than build the product themselves. So more of that Android versus iOS model, I guess, when it comes to vehicles. And, you know, Apple is often not the first to market with new technologies, but I think the advantage that Apple has, and this is my opinion now, is that they tend to bring out more mass consumer ready products. So, you know, what they're going to bring to market, I think, is going to be much more robust and much more ready to go out of the gate than, you know, if they tried to rush something out here in 2017, 2018. And I think it's often a key to their success. If you look at the iPod, not the first MP3 player, but the best one. Look at the iPhone, not the first smartphone to hit the market, but the best one. You know, the most consumer friendly, ready to go, integrated products and services, the whole package. And that's really what Apple is going to be focused on. And I think Musk seems to agree with that. It, you know, basically he summed it up saying they're going to make a good car and they're going to be successful at it. How successful, you know, remains to be seen. And we'll probably have to wait till 2020 to find out. But again, good positive words from Musk on the Apple Car. And with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Now let's move on. Let's talk a little bit more about that idea of the Siri Hub. And I want to talk about it a bit more because I want to comment on some things that Matt had to say in this voicemail he left for me.
Hey, Adam, I wanted to bring up a discussion about kind of these smart home devices that are kind of just sitting and listening to you, like Amazon Echo and now Google Home. And, you know, ever since Google announced Home, there kind of seems to be an uprising of people wanting to have Apple enter this space as well, which, I mean, I wouldn't mind, but I see a problem with that. And the problem is stemming from, you know, if I say, Ahoy Siri, you know, my phone goes off. If my watch is in the right position, it goes off. And if I have my iPad Pro sitting there, it'll go off. But then all three start listening and, you know, they generally all three give the same response, but you never know with Siri. But adding in an Apple device that kind of sits there and listens for that as well just kind of seems to add to the problem. So I wanted to bring up the discussion of, okay, if Apple does this, I surely feel like they would recognize the problem of, you know, four devices going off at once. And heck, if they add it to OS X or Mac OS, whatever they call it, that's yet another device that's sitting there that is accepting those commands. So I see a problem with that. So I'm wondering if Apple should develop some sort of location-aware system that kind of recognizes that, hey, iPhone, iPad, and watch, you know, you have all your devices in this same room as this you know, newly created Apple device that's sitting there always listening. And if those are all, you know, by each other, then only this new Apple device accepts the command. But if you're off in another room, away from that device, you know, maybe then all of your devices that are near you at that point kind of figure out which one actually accepts that command. So I think before Apple introduces a product like this, if they do, I think they have a lot of issues to work out regarding, you know, which device is the appropriate one to accept that command. Didn't know what your thoughts were on that, or if you have noticed that as a problem in your day-to-day use of your Apple devices. Thanks, Adam.
Yep, I definitely have noticed that as an issue, especially when I'm getting in my car. Very often I will try to use a voice command to get Siri to start up a podcast or start playing music. And usually because of, you know, I'm putting my hands up onto the steering wheel, the Apple Watch is in a position to also respond to that command. And oftentimes the Apple Watch will respond and my iPhone will not, when I really want my iPhone to do that and my Apple Watch to not respond to that. So one trick that I've learned getting in the car is now I've got muscle memory. If you make sure that you turn the Apple Watch before you give the Siri command so that it's facing down or facing away from you, it generally won't activate. So that's how I work around that. But you're right. I mean, we shouldn't have to do that. And I've actually talked about this for a while, that it's never made sense to me that Apple hasn't added some sort of context awareness or awareness of other devices to their systems. And this would include also notification systems as well. Or more importantly, how about the, you know, when you can get a phone call on your Mac or your iPhone or your Apple Watch, setting up some sort of hierarchy and knowing that, okay, my phone is next to my Mac right now and my watch, and probably the device that I'd prefer to take the phone call on is going to be my iPhone. And you only need to ring my iPhone. You don't need to have everything ringing. I've even had scenarios where I pick up my phone and I think my Mac is still ringing. And I'm sure that the person on the other end of the line can hear it. And they're probably wondering, what is going on? Is he getting two phone calls? What's happening? But yeah, the same thing needs to happen for Siri as well, especially if there's going to be multiple potential inputs. I think it only makes sense. And with low energy Bluetooth, it should be able to tell at least what other devices are nearby. The question is going to be, you know, that range is pretty decent. So, you know, maybe if you're in the other room, how are you going to know that, this instance, I want to use the iPhone, even though, you know, I'm only 100 feet or 50 feet from where my actual, you know, hub is, my home Siri hub or whatever that new product is going to be. So there's some tricky challenges to get around, but I totally get your point. I'd really like to see it be a user setting or a user preference where I can set a hierarchy, just sort of like you do with your network interfaces that you set up on your Mac. You know, you can drag those into a specific order and say, okay, try to start with this one first. And if that doesn't work, you know, fall back to the second one, third one, and fourth one. But absolutely, I totally agree with that. And I think that would make a lot of sense. So thanks for your comment and know that you are not alone in your thinking. This week, I discovered a pretty cool website if you're a Google user that I want to point you to. And I know that, you know, this is generally an Apple and Mac show, but I think a lot of us use Gmail or Google search, especially if you're using Safari. And one thing you might not recognize or realize is that all of your search history, all of that data is captured and stored by Google. And even if you did know that, did you know you actually can go view all that data and see all that historical data and manage it on a website at Google. There's a Google history website, history.google.com. If you go there, it will let you see much of the data that Google has gathered on you, including your search history from Google, your searches on YouTube, the videos you've watched on YouTube, any searches done through Google Voice services like Hey Google, and you can see location data as well from places that you've been, trips that you've gone on, stuff you've done with Google Maps. All of that stuff is in there and even more. And more importantly, the site will allow you to clear the history and data as well as access the preferences to control what data is being captured and collected. So when you go on the website, if you click the little what I call the hamburger icon, or many people call the hamburger icon, the, you know, the three little lines that look like bun, patty, bun. You may or may not know that that's what that's called. But yeah, click on that on the left-hand side and you can access the various sections of data, whether it's Google search or the YouTube stuff or the map data and stuff like that. And you can also search in there, and there's a little calendar icon so you can filter the dates of the data that was collected as well. And YouTube searches were, I noticed, kind of hard to search for because of the live search feature of YouTube. So it has like every variant of every letter that you've ever entered into a YouTube search. So that wasn't particularly useful. But point is you can filter that data down and you can find the entries that maybe you want to remove or expunge from your history if you don't want to expunge everything. And it has some other interesting data. It gives you kind of an overall overview of what your top searches were for a given month or a year. Also shows how many searches you've done, say, last year. So for me, I did 10,794 Google searches. And it was no surprise when it came up with the top search results that Stack Overflow and WordPress Codex and WordPress were some of the top sites for me visiting, because I do WordPress development and I'm looking for code hints and documentation and stuff like that. So, you know, there weren't surprises in there, but it was kind of surprising to see the vast amount of data that is collected and how it can all relate and stuff like that. Another thing you can access from that hamburger menu at the bottom is, like I said, the activity controls, and that allows you to set up and turn on or off the different features that are being used and collected and gathered. Just be aware, though, that if you disable the settings, some of the Google Smarts will no longer work. So, you know, being able to recommend things based on location or those sorts of things. And for example, I've had the voice search and command history disabled since the very beginning, because it actually captures the audio. And you can listen back to the audio voice searches that you've done using Google Voice. So, like, you know, the Hey Google kind of stuff. And you may want to clear that out. You know, it may be data or you know, audio information that you don't want floating around. I've also disabled the information from your devices, and that would be things including like contacts, calendars, apps, and other device data, because I don't use those services with Google. I use iCloud services for that. So I don't want any of that stuff collected or shared. I have that stuff from, say, my Google Gmail account, but I just don't want that being collected or tracked or anything like that. So I turn that off. And so on the one hand, seeing all this collected data, I think, is creepy. It gives you a sense of the vast amount of personal information that's collected on you by Google. And, you know, by proxy, also what others like law enforcement or government with a, you know, a valid search warrant could request from Google. It's the kind of data that they could actually glean from Google. So when you're looking at that, you kind of think about that, like, what have I been searching? And what, and you really could go back through your history. I could find certain periods of time and go, oh yeah, that's when I was planning out that trip to, you know, wherever, because I was doing all searches related to that, or that's when I was working on that project or this project. So, you know, you really can take these little puzzle pieces that seem not connected and start to connect them together and get a pretty good picture of who you are as a person and what kinds of things you're into and what you do. So being able to clear that out is kind of nice. You know, for me, it showed locations and dates of places that I went to going back several years. I had forgot some of it, but, you know, there it was. And it was actually kind of handy. It was like, oh, yeah, I remember that was back in October of 2014 when I went to that place. And when I had that conference over there. And you actually have actual dates, but at the same time, it's a little bit scary. On the other hand, though, I do have to applaud Google for the transparency and control that they're giving you with this website, because, you know, you can really control what data they have and access it and remove it and delete it and expunge it if you want to do that. But again, only if you know about it, which is why I'm telling you about this. And to be totally fair and balanced, Apple also collects similar types of data. The big difference, though, is that it's really kept private at Apple and only for your use. I'd need to go deeper into Google's terms of service to figure it out, but historically, Google tends to share a lot of the data and information that they have about you. But one particular one that I've talked about in the past, but I want to reiterate because a lot of people don't know this exists, is location data on you, specifically the frequent locations that you visit. I think Apple holds and keeps about a 30-day backlog of this information. So if you go on your iOS device into Settings, Privacy, Location Services, and then scroll way down to the bottom, you'll see something called System Services. Go in there, and then again toward the bottom, you'll see something called Frequent Locations. If you go into that section, you can see and clear the data for the places that you've visited most often if you use location services at all. And tapping on a location will allow you to see the points on the map, actually mapped out on an Apple map, that you visit. And you can also get that as a list view. And then also, just while you're in there, in the privacy controls in general, you'll notice you have access and the ability to control which apps have access to location and when they have that access, whether it's while you're using the app or always or never. And you can change those settings. And I often try to remember to go through those every once in a while because I forget what apps have I allowed to access my location and which ones do I really not want to have that access anymore. And you can turn that on and off. So again, Apple gives you a lot of transparency and controls just like Google. But again, only if you know where to look and only if you remember, oh yeah, I have access to that stuff. I know how to go look at it and manage it. So hopefully this tip helps a couple of you out. Now let's talk a little bit, revisit something that we talked about a month ago. I know this is a podcast and very often you're listening to these weeks, if not months later. And that was going on for Scott when we were talking about the whole app business and Smile Software's transition to a subscription-based model. And so Scott had, I thought, a couple of great comments related to that. So here's Scott.
Hey, Adam. This is Scott in D.C. We've conversed before. I'm a little behind in my listening, but I came across the the 12th or 13th episode talking about the situation with Smile Software. There are really a couple of issues that I want to take you to minor task on. One, I hate the commentary, the quote-unquote race for the bottom. It's not a race for the bottom. This is called free enterprise, free market economics, something that the software industry really hadn't participated in until they were forced to by Apple. When there are alternatives, when there are other ways of buying software, where alternatives in the market forces take approach, price is something that has to be expendable. This is part of economics 101. And I know that you're a professional developer and you may not want to hear this because this is just the way the market is. And price is a determining factor. So this concept of the race for the bottom is, if a developer doesn't want to price their software that low, then they don't have to price their software that low. If they think they can make the differentiation on quality over price, then that's the market. I mean, look at Apple. Apple doesn't make its differentiation on price. It makes its differentiation on quality. You can't do both quality and price. Studies have said it doesn't work. That's number one. Number two, the subscription model. When the subscription model gives you options that you don't want to pay for, that you have no need to pay for, then that's where I think that Smile went wrong with their initial announcement. They thought that they were doing this whiz-bang great feature for their customers, where I'm willing to bet that a good number of their customers really don't care about the sharing. They care about the syncing and would love the syncing, but sharing, I don't want to share my snippets. I don't share my snippets with everybody. And if there is a small snippet that I have my wife use, then we create it. It's not that big of a deal. There aren't that many. The other aspect of the economics is community versus business. I think you were more upset on the reaction to Smile, whether it be through social media or whatever, versus what business is. Business is not community. Community is not business. There is a customer-business relationship that you can use to form a community type of relationship, which is what Apple does. But don't mistake what business is for a community. I think you were more upset over the reaction to Smile, what social media said to Smile, and I think partially also because you admitted you know a lot of people there, and they may have confided in you that they really probably took the reaction very hard. And that's understandable. They should have tried to reach out for a different type of reaction, try to test the water, so to speak, to see what happened. And they learned from it, and we moved on. This has nothing to do with community. It's economics. It's business. Business is business.
Hey, I would say, yes, this is absolutely about business. And I really appreciate your feedback because I agree with you on a lot of levels. And I just probably need to clarify my position a little bit and give a little more color to this conversation. So thank you for, you know, bringing this back up again. And I think, you know, when I say race to the bottom, I use it more as a description of behavior, not necessarily as a market force. So I'm not saying that developers are forced in a race to the bottom. I'm saying it's a behavior that they're participating in. But I don't necessarily think that, you know, it's something that is being forced or necessarily is happening not by choice. Yes, there is economic pressure to price software cheaper, but as you point out, that's the free market. That's sort of how it works. And as you also point out, you know, developers also get to make that choice on their own. So, you know, I'm all about responsibility on all sides of this argument as well, both the consumer side and the developer side. And that's where, you know, I think many developers are going wrong. You know, they are not valuing their software. And that's the exact problem that I'm talking about that I think needs to change. Part of that issue, though, I think, is that many software developers are doing everything themselves. You know, we're talking about the small guys. We're not talking about the Adobes and the Microsofts of the world, or maybe even the Smiles. I think Smile really has a lot of knowledge, and they know what they're doing when they're making these kinds of decisions. But many software developers are not marketers. They're not business managers. They don't understand business economics. And that's a deficiency that they have. And they probably need to either train themselves a little bit more, or they need to partner up with somebody to take care of some of those things, figure out what is my correct, you know, price to sales ratio. But in order to get promotion and marketing, a lot of them feel this pressure that, well, the only way I can do that is to get on the top 10 list, and the only way I can get on the top 10 list is to lower my price or give my software away. And that can ultimately be very detrimental to their business. And that's just the bad economy that ends up getting set up for a number of various reasons. And, you know, and that's what creates this behavior of race to the bottom. I think more developers need to partner with marketers and business managers to kind of figure that stuff out. On the whole Smile and community thing, My issue with the community was the reaction of the community, and specifically that the community was treating Smile like they were supposed to just be their friend, and that, you know, Smile sort of owed them something when they made their business decision. And don't misunderstand me. Smile is a great company. I think they have very much have value for the community and their customers and the people, and they care about what those people think, which I think is why they had the reaction that they did to what was going on, and why they kind of rethought some things and changed a couple things. You know, I have a lot of friends there, as you pointed out. You know, these are my friends, but I also have a business relationship with them as well. And you're right to point out these are very different things, and it can get muddled and it can get confused. So really what I was trying to convey to the community is that, you know, this specific decision shouldn't be taken personally. It is a business decision. It was not a slight to them. It wasn't something that Smile chose to do to them, but that's how many people were reacting, like a friend somehow had betrayed them. And, you know, I was arguing that when these things happen, we need to step back and consider the possibility that Smile made this purely as a business decision, that they looked at their business, they evaluated it. And to be honest, I don't know. I haven't had a direct conversation with them about the choice. I'm just speculating here, but I'm willing to accept, knowing that they're smart, intelligent people, that they've been in our software community for a long time, that they stepped back, they looked at their business, they evaluated the market, they evaluated the pricing and the features and all of those sort of things, factored everything together and went, this is what we need to do for our business. This is just the decision we need to make. And yes, not everybody's going to be happy with it, but going forward, this is the business that we want to go after. And I think based on some of the things that were released, my assumption is that they said, you know, we want to focus a little bit more on our corporate customers, the kind of people that do want to share snippets, that do have teams, that use our software in this sort of scenario. And they made that thinking, this is right for our business. So you're absolutely right. Business is business. And that's what was going on. But again, getting back to this idea of community, in the world of Apple, as you pointed out, business and community are closely tied, and they often get mixed up. So this isn't exclusively a Smile thing or a reaction. This conversation was just predicated by something that happened at one event at one time, but we've seen the same reaction happen in our community over and over again. Look at what happened to Marco Armont when he brought out Peace, his ad blocker, and the reaction from the podcast community, because he's deeply involved in that. And a lot of podcasters, myself included, make our money from advertising, or a lot of his friends who do blogs and things like that make their money from advertising. So they reacted very personally, like personally insulted and upset and outraged. And, you know, it caused Marco to kind of rethink and backtrack a little bit. And that's his decision to make as a business owner. I don't begrudge him either decision, the decision to make the software or the decision to pull back on it. It was a great piece of software. I was kind of sad that he pulled back on it, because I thought it was a great ad blocker. And I think that's something that a lot of people want and need. But he decided, I'm going to leave that business to others out there, and I'm going to let others do that. I'm going to pull out of it. And that's fine. That's his business decision to make. Look at the reaction to Apple when Apple kills off a product like Aperture, or they change something like Final Cut or OS X. Many long-standing customers feel personally slighted and like Apple is doing this to them, and how dare they, and they owe me to make the software that I want them to make, not the software that they want to make or they feel is right for their business. It happens time and time again. I hear all the time from pros and higher education customers that Apple has abandoned them, that, you know, as they focus more on iOS and consumer products, you know, they left them behind. And how dare they, because I'm the one that supported them through the bad time in the 90s, and I was buying their software, and they owe me, Apple owes me a new Mac Pro because I'm more devoted to the platform and I'm a better customer. And, you know, it's crazy, but I totally understand it. I get it. We feel connected to Apple and our community. We spend so much time with these products, and there's this real connection, and it hurts when it feels like we've been wronged or abandoned or somehow slighted. And so my last point, and I think the thing to remember, is that this is our community. So when things happen and a business decision is made or something changed, rather than our first reaction being anger or frustration and lashing out, that we try to step back and understand the decision from another member of our community's point of view. And their perspective may be a different perspective than ours. You know, we might have a consumer perspective where they have a business perspective, but we can still all be in the same community. And, you know, they are a business and they can't always necessarily be our friend when, you know, even though many times they are that also, right? They're our friends. They're also the companies that help serve us and make our lives better through the products and software that they make. So it gets a little bit muddied. And I think ultimately we're talking about the same thing. We're trying to make the same points, and maybe it just didn't come across that clear. And so that's why I thought it was great that you sent in your feedback. And that's what this is all about too, right? It's being able to have this conversation and get everybody's point of view and sort these things out and think through it a little bit more so that we all become better, better members of this great community that we have. So thanks again for your voicemail. And then finally, a little technical issue potentially for owners of the iPhone SE. And this comment came in from Philip, and I found it quite interesting. And we're going to do a little R&D. We want to do a little research. So please listen to this if you're an iPhone SE customer, and see if you can work through this issue that Philip is having, and give us a little feedback.
Hi, Adam. This is Philip calling from Germany. I'm calling to tell you about a little problem that I have with my iPhone 6 SE. And it has to do with the camera. I got the iPhone immediately when it came out because I was very excited about the having a small form factor again. I had an iPhone 6S and I sold that one, and for the money that I got for that, because it was still pretty new, I was able to pay for the iPhone 6 SE. And 2 weeks after I received that phone, I realized there's something wrong with the camera. And what it is the camera is slightly rotated in the chassis. So it's about 1 degree off. And so what that means is when you're shooting a picture, say in landscape, your horizon wouldn't be parallel to the phone edges. And it doesn't sound like much. It sounds a bit ridiculous, actually, 1 degree, but it actually is quite an annoyance, and it's throwing me off because I'm trying to take very precise photographs. And so what I did to recheck this, because I was out in the landscapes and shooting landscapes and I was irritated by this, I came back home and I tried this on an edge, just a straight line. I was trying to see whether the phone is parallel to this edge, while also the grid lines on the phone screen are aligned with that line that I'm shooting. And it turns out it's not the case. So it's definitely the camera that is slightly rotated in the chassis. I contacted Apple support and they said, okay, that's an issue. You should go into the local Apple Store and have it fixed. And they were trying to set me up with an appointment for a few weeks, and they didn't manage to do that because it's so busy there. So in the end they said, you know, go to a local authorized reseller and get it fixed there under guarantee. And I did that, and 2 weeks later, it took 2 weeks for them to get back to me and say, there's nothing wrong with your hardware. And I thought, well, that's not right. And so I finally managed to get an appointment in my local Apple store here in Berlin. And I went in, and the guy there was very nice, and he recognized the issue. I showed it to him. He could see what I mean. And we compared this to my iPhone 5S, which has a perfect alignment of the camera with the device edges, and also an iPhone 6S, which also has a perfect alignment of the edges and the camera. So he said, no problem, I'll give you a new device. He gave me a new device. We turned it on just to make sure this doesn't have that issue. And what do you know, it turns out it does have the same issue. And so we were very surprised by that. And we went over to the table with all the iPhones and we tried two more iPhone SEs. And turns out they all had the same issue with slightly varying degrees, but all the cameras were slightly off, I would say in the range of between 0.5 and 1.5 or 2 degrees angle. And so he said, well, I can't really help you right now with that because obviously, you know, there's no point in going through, you know, 20 iPhones just to see whether one of them might not have this issue. And I'm fine with that. I can see you can't really do any better than giving me a new phone. He said he would escalate that up to the engineering team in Cupertino, which sounds interesting. I'm curious to see what's going to happen with that. So this might be an early production issue, which they maybe sort out at some point. So I will definitely go in before my guarantee runs up, to try to get a replacement then and see whether they fix the issue in the meantime. And yeah, so I would be really interested to know if any other of your listeners have noticed this issue or whether they will notice this issue now that I've told you about it. And I will be looking out in the news to see whether anyone else sort of realizes this issue. Thank you, Adam, for your hard work and your really good show. I've been listening to close to 10 years and I always enjoy it. Thanks, bye.
Hey, Philip, thanks for being a longtime listener and contributor to the show. I know you've contributed in the past. And sorry you're having this issue with your iPhone, but I think you're dead on. I mean, it's a newer product, so maybe there's some sort of production issue. And I tried this little trick with my iPhone 6S, and it seems to have perfect alignment. And so what we're going to ask is that you, if you have an iPhone SE especially, that you try this little trick. And Philip did send me an image of this issue. So I will try to post that with the show at maccast.com. And I think the best way to do this is if you do have the problem, if you do notice that you have the same issue on your iPhone SE, if you could just post something in the comments at maccast.com for this episode, we'll kind of track and see how many people have noticed this issue. And the best way, it seems like the easiest way to do this, the way I did it and the way that was shown in Philip's photo, was one, turn the grid lines on your iPhone camera app. So if you go into the settings into the camera, if you don't have them on already, turn on the grid lines. And then what you can do is take a piece of paper, just, you know, like a standard sheet of paper, white paper, put it flat on a table, and then place the iPhone pointing with the camera straight down. And I think the easiest way to do it is get like a glass. I know I just use like a pint glass or any kind of glass, and then kind of set it on top of the glass and then align the phone grid and the phone pointing straight down at the paper where the edge of the paper lines up with the grid line on the display so that you know it's perfectly aligned straight with the horizon. And then once you've done that, look straight down at the edge of the phone relative to the edge of the paper. And if everything's in perfect alignment, all of those things should be straight. But what you'll notice if you look at Philip's photo is that the phone, the edge of the phone and the edge of the paper, even though it's lined up perfectly on the line on the display, there's an obvious angle difference between, and again, it's about probably about 1 degree, like he describes, between the edge of the phone and the edge of the paper. So that's the effect that you're looking for in testing this. And like I said, report back, let us know in the comments, or even if you just want to email me, that's fine. I can kind of keep track and I'll update you on a future episode, but we may have discovered a little production error. And it's probably just however they do the alignment at the factory, there's some sort of issue. And who knows, maybe it's just a certain batch of phones. It might be, you know, minute and limited, but until we test it out, we're really not going to know. So Philip, thanks for bringing this to our attention, and we are on it, the community's on it, and we will see what we can come up with. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander Touch for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of Smile Software at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth at gazelle.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also leave a voicemail on the listener hotline. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9, or you can leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype username is the MacCast. And if you need show notes, links to anything I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you're on social media, you'd like to follow me, twitter.com/maccast. And please follow me. I'm trying to get my numbers up over, I think, 15,000 followers. And you can help do that. If you're on Twitter, follow me, twitter.com/maccast. You can also check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast. And if you're on Google Plus, you can find the MacCast Google Plus community at google.com/plusMacCast. And those are all the places you can follow me between shows. But until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.